careful. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I think we can start, but I'm going to... You talked about your bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. Could you please tell me?
Now, I was bar mitzvah in Ambridge.
In a building, and we didn't get the name of the building.
That was the old real estate office of Ben Labor's. That was our community synagogue.
Okay.
That was our shul. They now have a permanent shul down there since I moved out of there. But that's where our shul was. So
and
we rented that building.
And who instructed you? Was it Mr. Berger?
No. My instructor was Kalman Levine. Kalman worked, he sold schmatiks. He was in the
rag business.
Uptown Fifth Avenue. You know, they sold whatever it was. The small town merchants would come in, and that's the business he was in. But at 3:30, 3 o'clock every day, he'd get on a highway or motor coach bus and get down to Ambridge and teach Hebrew school from 4 until 6, get back on a bus and come home. And we had Hebrew school from Monday through Thursday. And I was bar mitzvahed in Ambridge. I remember Mr. Levine, who we just loved, we adored. I came home one day with a tzitzis on, and my father almost fell out of the chair, but I wore the tzitzis for a couple of weeks. And then when I got my tefillin, T-E-F-I-L-L-E, and this ending, my son-in-law still lays tefillin.
Really?
Yeah. I think he's afraid the roof would fall on if he doesn't. At any rate, Mr. Levine, knowing my sort of reform background, although we belong to the community there, and we also belong to the shul in McKeesport, which my grandfather belonged to, which was Gemenos Chesed, which is still in McKeesport. At that time, it was down on 3rd Avenue, down near the river.
I have the spelling.
And we used to go to services there, but I was bar mitzvah in Ambridge, actually. And Kalman Levine wanted me to promise after I was bar mitzvah that I would forever continue to lay tefillin. And I knew at that time I could never keep that promise. And I wouldn't keep the promise, and we became very, very good friends because he knew that I was telling him the truth. I wasn't going to do it. But I learned a lot of Judaism there. But I got to tell you, so much of it was in Hebrew, which I would read. I can still read Hebrew very well, very rapidly. And it just... it didn't give me enough, although the spirit and the ritual was marvelous. And that's something that never gets out of your genes. You have that, it's there. But that was my bar mitzvah was there.
You also have talked about your father was a coin.
Grandfather was a coin. When I used to go to the Eastport, he'd sit up in the front facing the congregation. That's where the coins sat. And I used to have to sit in his lap, and my uncles and my father, as they filled her out, if they had enough of the services, I had to go out, pull them back in from the sidewalk and say, Grandpa wanted them back in again. I remember there, Gemenos Chesed, it was a two-story shul. The first floor was the men, and the second floor was the women. And there was a curtain all around the second floor. Women were behind the curtain up on the second floor. But my mother made it very clear from day one that she was not subservient to anyone. So we really didn't believe that that meant anything anyway. I guess I never did realize what all that was.
Howard, you mentioned that your mother was active in the National Council of Jewish Women in Ambridge.
She was active in the National Council of Jewish Women.
And then also a Gentile club. What was the name of that club?
The Ambridge Women's Club.
The Ambridge Women's Club.
Yeah. And we belonged to a lot of men. You know, being in business there, you belong to a lot of things, mainly because of business.
Howard, you mentioned that there was subtle anti-Semitism. I heard that on the tape. I mean, I got the notes on that. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, every once in a while you'd hear, you'd be walking along with someone else, Jiddick. Jiddick in Polish means Jew. And I don't know why, but it never really bothered me because, I guess because I was always so big. No one ever really took me on. So that... and I
how tall are you?
Well, I was 6'4 and a half. Beverly has me down to about 5'6". But I am a couple inches shorter than I used to be. But at any rate, I always figured, you know, like, look, that's the way they are. That's the way it is. I was able to do everything I wanted. I was able to achieve everything I wanted.
Okay. Who was Morris Fanner?
Who?
Morris Fanner. F-A-N-N-E-R.
My father's name was Morris, and my mother's name was Fanny. Maybe that's what you're...
Something wrong. Okay, all right.
That's what it was.
Anyway. You also talked about how generous your father was with the when the times were hard, and you said you felt that that made things very... that people really appreciated
it. Yeah, this is when he extended credit.
Right.
When the poor would come by, the beggars would come by, and he always had a ring of bologna or a hunk of... a loaf of bread or a hunk of salami, something for them. And it was a good lesson to learn that you took care of those who couldn't take care of themselves or wouldn't take care of themselves, I guess. And then in medical school, I was active also in a Jewish community then. My first real activity started while I was in medical school. I think I mentioned before,
yes,
last time, Dan Balsam, B-A-L-S-A-M. At that time, was head of the youth group, United Jewish Federation. At that time, wasn't the United Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh, the United Jewish Federation. And, as a matter of fact, wasn't the United Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh in 1973. And Beverly, my wife, helped start the of Greater Pittsburgh. She was asked to come on by Jerry Soroker, who at that time was head of the executive director of Federation. She was asked, it was right after the Yom Kippur War in 73, and she was asked to come on for 2 or 3 months as paid worker to organize. And she left 3 years later. But at any rate, the Dan Balsam, and I can still remember, the chairman of the youth division was Lester Hamburg. That's a way back. We had very active groups. Dan Balsam was very stimulating to us. Our class in medical school, we were brown baggers. Many of the guys couldn't afford to go out to lunch. Carried a brown bag, not because they were dieting. They carried a brown bag because that was it. That was their lunch. And I remember I helped organize Elaine Kessler, who practiced neurosurgery here in the city for years, over at Allegheny General. Elaine and I did a lot of work with the graduate schools. I helped set up the graduate schools in the city. Duquesne Graduate School, Carnegie Mellon, Pitt.
And you mentioned that everybody gave $25.
That's right.
How did you establish $25?
I don't know how the hell we got to that number, but it was $25 a person. And 25 bucks was a lot of money then for guys who were carrying brown bags. But that's the way it was. So that many of us got into the swing of things with that. I'll never forget my senior year, just before the final exams, the young adult division had a retreat. At that time, it was at the old Emma Farm out in Harmony. And it was a weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And I can still remember what he had, but he keeps reminding me how I backed him up against the tree and gave him a shot of penicillin. John Wolfe, who was active at that time. John was sick, he had fever or something, and I gave him a shot. He says, I don't remember the exact thing, but he says, I backed him up against the tree and Labe held him, and I shot him. But these are the kinds of things. It was a very stimulating time. This was before 1948, before Israel was Israel. And then we graduated in April 48. And after that, I was active all through my training period.
How soon after you graduated from medical school did you get married?
Graduated from medical school in April of 48, and Beverly and I got married in October 1951. I had already spent, I was recalled.
Yep. We're gonna go. Yep, we're gonna go.
Yeah, when I was in the Navy Reserve.
No, excuse me for a moment. You talked about the fact that your father decorated your store with a Christmas tree and that you had menorahs at home and that what was business was business. And I'd like you to elaborate on it. I think it's a wonderful story.
The Christmas trees were little. He never had a Christmas tree, but they used to decorate the store. There were big mirrors, I remember, behind the meat counter, and all the green finery around that, and they used to paint the scenes. They used to paint scenes on the mirrors, and then from the lights through the store, they would have the all the decorations, and they were put up, well, I guess about 2 weeks before Christmas, and they weren't taken down until after the Russian Christmas, because there were a lot of Russians in Anchorage. At home, we never had a Christmas tree. We celebrated Hanukkah, and our Gentile friends couldn't wait to come over and had the potato latkes and celebrated Hanukkah. And one family in particular, Dr. Wolf's family, he was our family doctor, Charlie Wolf, who was a very good Gentile, had two children, Ginny Ann and Bill. They didn't trim the tree unless I was over there to trim the tree with them. But that's kind of the relationship.
It's nice. It's nice.
But you knew what you were, they knew what they were, and still we all enjoyed things together.
Okay, you also mentioned Michael Serene, who was the superintendent of schools.
Well,
now, what's
there,
super...
Michael Serene was taught me in undergraduate school. He taught me chemistry.
Oh, he's from the
physics.
University of Pittsburgh.
No, I didn't mean undergrad. When I was in high school,
okay.
He taught me chemistry, physics, etc., science. And then, after I left, he ended up a principal, and then ended up a superintendent of schools, and then moved on to California State, which is California, PA. And before he became a professor there, he was in physics there. When I graduated from medical school, I don't know how he knew the date or what, but as I was walking out of the procession, we graduated in Stephen Foster Memorial on the Pitt campus. As I was walking out, who's sitting in the back waving at me but Mike Serene, my old science teacher.
You mentioned on the tape that that's what's small town.
And as a result, when I went in as president of the County Medical Society, I had Mike Serene there that night. We had big festivities down at the Hilton Hotel. And Mike and his wife were there because his son is a surgeon over in Mount Lebanon. And,
I know him.
Who's Serene? Really?
That's Mike?
Oh, not my friend. Cambridge, Aliquippa. It's called
Beth
Samuel.
Beth Samuel is
Samuel.
It's the synagogue.
Now synagogue in Ambridge, which
okay.
Services Ambridge, Aliquippa. And I guess the people from Swickley and Edgeworth and that area, yeah. Because a lot of those Ambridge Jews moved up to Edgeworth and Swickley, which when I was a kid, no Jews lived there. Although, I must add, in high school, I don't know whether we have that here or not, I sort of led a dual life. I belonged to AZA, which was Olive Zadeh Galef, which was the youth group of B'nai B'rith. But I also belonged to DMLA, which was the youth group of the Masonic organization. And I was master counselor of DMLA in Swickley. Master counselor is the head of that. So, as I say, all these things, as I look back on them, I never gave it a whole lot of thought, but I look back, there was such a diverse background that really make you comfortable in so many situations.
Okay, your sister Eleanor went to Carnegie Tech, now CMU.
It was Carnegie Tech at the time, right?
That was Margaret Morrison?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And she was secretarial teaching?
She was in secretarial, yeah. She taught the Ambridge School, then over in Langley for years in secretarial studies, bookkeeping, accounting, typing, shorthand. That was Eleanor's thing.
Okay, now could you just tell me what your salary was when you were an intern at the unit?
As an intern, I had no salary. I got room, board, and laundry, and had to buy my own uniforms.
Okay.
As a resident, we got $41.66 a month after they deducted what had to be deducted. That was it.
Okay, this is what I want to know. I have on the tape, you talk about the McGee Hospital, then you talk about the Women's Hospital. We now know that it became McGee Women's, because
mm-hmm.
When it was McGee, it was men and women that came into the hospital.
It was
right?
Mostly obstetrics.
Right, but weren't there some men?
Oh, sure.
That, yeah.
There were some men at McGee.
I didn't know that.
In medicine.
Okay, then, when was the merge, Western Psych, the Municipal Hospital?
Well, Municipal Hospital, that's right, that was part of it, too. After polio, see, the infectious diseases, you know, the baddies, like the smallpox, well, hell, that was out before. I got diphtheria, that was out. And most of it was 150 or 200 polio cases we were recuperating up there. Well, when that went out, after Salk, the Municipal Hospital closed, and that became Salk Hall. That's where the dental school is now.
Okay, could you talk to me about Dr. Salk, when you he was at the University of Pittsburgh.
When I was in medical school, he was doing his original research.
And are you, can you express some of your feelings now as a physician? What was your opinion of his research and of the results? Because there's such questions.
Well,
I know there are, and I'd like your opinion.
I happen to have respected Salk tremendously. Let's face it, the Nobel Prize didn't go to him. The Nobel Prize then went to a Dr. Enders, E-N-D-E-R-S, from Harvard, who first was able to isolate the poliovirus. It was on the rhesus monkey. And once the virus was isolated, that was the big part. But Salk was very brave in his approach and felt very confident in the way he was going to do the vaccine. It was a killed vaccine, which also was a new approach. He didn't use killed vaccines for these things. And he developed the killed vaccine. And I think where the big controversy came, Julie Younger, who is a marvelous man, he's still around the medical school. Julie is not a physician, he's a PhD. Julie was one of Salk's right-hand men. And Julie, when all this thing broke, John Trone, who ended up the editor of the Pittsburgh Press, at that time was the science writer first for the Pittsburgh Press, then a science writer for the Scripps Howard newspapers. And John and Salk befriended one another, and John broke the big story. And everything was Salk. And Jonas really didn't mention all his first lieutenants who did yeoman work. Julie Younger, I don't think has ever forgotten.
Well, how do you feel about that? How would you feel about that?
I probably would have resented it, too.
Why did you respect him? You feel that he just had...
Well, I think he did a tremendous amount. I mean, he helped conquer this. Now, of course...
What about Sabin? Yeah.
Sabin, who, to this day, Sabin and Salk despise one another. And Sabin feels that Salk really didn't do much. It was Enders and that group that did it. And that he just got in the coattails. Which I don't think is exactly true. Historically, I think it's wrong. But Sabin, with the live virus vaccine, which is really what we still use at this point, because what it does, it develops antibodies in the gut. And he also sheds some live virus. And it's what we call the herd effect, so that the whole community still gets small doses of this poliovirus, not enough that they get sick, but to keep giving antibodies. And this is where the live virus vaccine, the trivalent, you know, there's type 1, type 2, type 3 polio, has all three types in it. And it's proven to be a very excellent stand-up kind of thing. Depending on who you read, anywhere from 1 in 600,000 to 1 in 8.2 million doses can cause a disease. That's what Salk always said, my God, it can cause such a disease. Well, that's infinitesimal. When you figure in the mid-50s before the vaccine, this country alone used to have 20 to 40,000 cases of polio a year. We have not had an admission of polio to Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh since December 1963.
Now, what vaccine did you use?
Originally, the killed, Salk. And then when it became apparent, the Academy of Pediatrics started to recommend, and we followed through all these years, we used the Sabin vaccine. We've used it for years. Salk, interestingly enough, we had back in Pittsburgh, I think it's about 3 years ago now, maybe it was 4 years ago, we had a distinguished lecture series, 100th anniversary of the medical school. And I was co-chairman of the distinguished lecture series, which was 5 lectures, which included people who were in some way connected with Pitt Medical School through the years, who really made big names and who did good stuff. And one of them, the two I was in charge of the 5, was one was Salk, because they knew that I was of that vintage when I was in school, and the other was Peter Saffer. But anyway, Peter Saffer, before I get to him, Jonas, I was told, will you please call him? I was told he's an irascible old man. At that time, he was 72. I guess he's 76 now, so it must have been 4 years ago. But he probably won't come, and he'll really give you that over the phone. It turned out when I called, his secretary, who was his secretary here, who incidentally was Jewish, answered the phone. He was out of the country. And I gave her all the information. She said, he'll be there. And when he got back, she called. Sure enough, he came. And give me his whole approach to things. She sent out a letter letting us know that he did not want a big affair the night of the lecture. There were 750 physicians sitting in Scaife Hall listening to him, which was sort of a disappointing lecture because it really wasn't on research, etc. He's really gotten into
AIDS,
real philosophy.
Oh, yes, I know.
Become a real philosopher.
Nut.
That's right, a bit of a nut with it. And many of us really don't understand half of what he says with it for one reason. It's very difficult for you to connect everything he says with this. But anyway, he's, as far as I'm concerned, he's a legend in his own time. And I was just excited as could be. I was like a little kid that he was coming. I met him at the airport, as a matter of fact. By the time we got him into Pittsburgh, he was staying at the university club. By the time I got him into Pittsburgh, he'd already told me how bad Sabin was, how he'd just come back the weekend before from France, where he was working on the AIDS thing, where what it was then, it was a peacekeeping kind of thing, get the French and the Americans together, where there'd be some peace between them to do some individual research together. And anyway, he had the 750 at this lecture, but he made it clear he didn't want a big affair that night, which most of us, we usually have it either one of the clubs in town or a hotel or a place at the school. And he said he just wanted a small group, 20, 25 people. And he had a list of three different people in town that he wanted. One was John Truman. One was Ted Banowski, who was professor of research medicine at that time. And the other was Lowenthal, Alex Lowenthal. Evidently, they were very close friends when he was in town. I have a feeling maybe Alex Lowenthal must have invested money for him, I don't know. At any rate, and what he wouldn't eat certain. He wouldn't eat desserts, he wouldn't eat fried, a little bit. Oh boy, I got a real cough. I'm going to run out of steam.
You need a doctor.
I'm going to run out of steam. No, I'm fine. At any rate, we all got together. What are we going to do? Where are we going to have it? They all looked at me and smiled. So I knew what they meant. I came home and I said, Bev, we've got a predicament. She said, don't look at me. And I said, I'm looking at you. Well, we had it. She said, I'm not using university cater. That's all there is to it. Which she didn't. And we had a lovely party here that invited John Trone as he wanted, invited, then the ones from the medical school were involved had to be there. There were 23 or 24 of us here.
Anybody's feelings hurt?
No. Julie Younger, incidentally, was invited. Okay. But at any rate, he was charming. Absolutely charming. He ate the potato latkes. We had Martin catered. You know his potato, he ate those. Everybody kept nudging me. Look, all the fried stuff there was, he ate every bit of that. My mother-in-law, when she heard John DeSalk was going to be here, she came in from Indianapolis, and she's a gourmet cook. So everybody said, what do we have for dessert? She says, I'll make apple pie. I said, Mother, how can you make apple pie? Everybody likes. She said, my apple pie, everybody likes. So she said, Jonas won't eat it. She says, he'll eat it. He not only ate a big piece of apple pie, he had ice cream pie. So it was that kind of a night, but it was a lot of fun. It really was. The heat bent. He got loose as could be. He was really a very charming guy. Took pictures with everybody individually. A monkey business. The next day we had Children's Hospital Alumni Day. He gave a talk on infectious diseases. With that, he gave seminars for the infectious disease residents, both at Presbyterian and at Children's. He spent a good 2 days here in Pittsburgh. And we got a lot out of him.
Was he compensated for it?
Yeah, but not. It was a.
Yeah.
He got a Distinguished Service Medal from the university. And then I was coming back home where he felt he was treated rather shabbily at the end. And I think it was sort of, here I am, I'm back. You know. And he's accepted very well. Except, as I say, the lecture was a bit disappointing.
New York Times had an article last week. Howard, about his new philosophy.
Yeah.
Was there a TB hospital in Pittsburgh?
Sure was. The Marcy Hospital up on Bedford Avenue.
Marcy?
M-A-R-C-Y, Dr. Marcy.
Okay.
Dr. Marcy was a tuberculosis specialist. Matter of fact, his son retired not too long ago, early retirement, was an anesthesiologist at Children's. But the old man was, Joe Marcy, was an internist who did pulmonary work, primarily tuberculosis. And in our junior year, we had to spend a certain amount of time there. And I remember I'd take a deep breath as I walked in the front door, and 3 hours later when I left, I'd beat the breath out. But good training. We really learned. We listened to a chest. We know what it was.
How many patients? How many beds?
Okay, I don't know how many beds, but it was a fair-sized place.
Were people at that time quarantined?
Yeah. We didn't have all the treatment we have now. We had streptomycin, but they used to do a lot of insert air into it and collapse the lung, let the lung heal and re-expand them again. These were back in the days when they used to go with Saranac Lake, is that what it was? So we're Saratoga Springs.
Where they Our president.
This was just where they had the tuberculosis hospitals.
But I thought that was part with where Roosevelt went.
No, he was Warm Springs,
Excuse
Georgia.
Me. Sorry.
He was Warm Springs, Georgia, for polio. But that's part of that.
Okay, you mentioned Dr. E.R. McCluskey, and he was your mentor.
He was
Could you give us
my sponsor. McCluskey probably...
Give me his title exactly where...
Dr. Edmund R. McCluskey was a practitioner in the city, always taught medical students at Children's, then became medical director at Children's Hospital, professor and chairman of the department, then became vice chairman of the schools of the health profession, then he died. He had cancer of the prostate and died at a probably early age, late 50s. But Mac had perfect connections in the mountains. He took care of all the mountains. And whenever he needed anything, he'd get on the telephone and call Richard King Mellon and get himself $20 million. I mean, it was that kind of a thing. It was a personal, you know, it's on the line. At any rate, he was a wonderful guy. I learned more of the art of medicine from him. As far as learning pediatrics itself, we had full-time guys. We knew their pediatrics. The smart thing about him, he knew how to surround himself with bright people. He had this one in diabetes, and he had this one in x-ray, and he had this one in anesthesia, and he had this one in something else. And he was covered. But he knew what strings to pull when he needed them. He was a master at handling people, at handling patients, as a consultant. I'll never forget my first year in practice. A doctor's child, 3 weeks of age, I made the diagnosis of meningitis. And I had a tough time with a father who was a contemporary of mine. His father, who was a very prominent physician, I sat ill with this nonsense. As soon as I went into the hospital, I called Dr. McCluskey to come up and see the kid. And he spent half his time telling them how fortunate they were to have me as their doctor, and there was nothing he could add. This was McCluskey. This is the way he did things.
That was your mentor.
That was my mentor. Matter of fact, when I finished my residency, I was seriously thinking, well, there were a couple of fellows that had gotten out a couple of years before me and weren't doing that well here in the open area, the swirling area. And I was thinking of different places to go. Lou Weiss wanted me to come down to Swickley and win the pediatrics there. McCluskey got wind of this. in his own inimitable way, he says, you're going nowhere. You're going to stay in Oakland, you're going to open up Oakland. And through him, he got me immediate referrals in OB through Charlie Baroni, B-A-R-O-N-E. Charlie Baroni was one of the OBs in town. And Howard Power, Power Irving and Stars. Howard Power, and he, first day I went into practice, they started to refer patients to me. That came under the auspices, there's no doubt about McCluskey. Some of his referring people, although he had physicians that took over his office, Fred Miller, who was a very good pediatrician, and Gene Howe, he turned over some of his referring men from the Boondocks to me. So I got referrals right away from that source. I wasn't the only one. I mean, this, he picked and chose, and the ones that he chose were lucky chosen. And I was lucky to be chosen. And he really helped start me, there's no doubt about it.
Is that how you become... I'm saying this, not you, and but since I'm a Pittsburgher, I'm qualified to say this. How do you get to be the in doc physician of one particular? I mean, it was Howard Mermelstein.
And not really.
That, well, being connected with Deer Creek, that was the name.
Well, I don't know. I can't explain. I don't know how you started, but I really don't know. I can't.
And how did when did Lou Myers come in?
Lou wasn't with me. He was OB.
Excuse me.
Bernie Michaels.
Bernie
is just, he's 8 years ahead of me. Bernie had his practice. I had my practice. Bill Bryant, we call him one.